Welcome to the Rights Track Podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing the world today. I'm Todd Landman, and in today's episode, we're asking, do NGOs matter? My guest is Amanda Murdy, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, who's been investigating how and when NGOs really make a difference. So welcome, Amanda. Thank you for joining us from all the way from Missouri.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you're most welcome with us today. I know there's a lot going on at Missouri and a lot going on in the United States at the moment, but we're going to focus our attention today on the role of NGOs and their work in the human rights field. But I'm going to start first by just saying that an NGO is a non-governmental organization. These are private, not-for-profit organizations. They vary in size and shape all over the world, and they exist at the domestic level as well as the international level. So I guess my first question to you is, what sorts of NGOs have you been investigating? Are they the domestic ones, the international ones, and are the human rights ones, and also ones that maybe work on different issues?
I would say all of the above. Most of my work focuses on international NGOs, and we define an international NGO as an organization that's involved in at least three countries at the same time. I usually focus on international organizations, probably because I'm an IR scholar, an international relations scholar. And so we like to focus on how things at the international level affect what's going on locally, so how a government treats their own citizens. Most of the time, I focus on organizations that have a human security focus. So they're either focused on freedom from fear, so we would think of those as human rights organizations, or they're organizations that are focusing more on economic, social, and cultural rights, or the freedom from want, and those would be things like development NGOs or health NGOs.
So just to clarify then, the economic and social rights claims are rights that are articulated in the International Covenant of Economic and Social Rights from 1966. This came into force in 1976, but it does specify a set of rights like the right to health, right to food, right to education, and really concern the sort of social welfare of people. And the interpretation today, really, that's popular in the jurisprudence of human rights is that there's a state obligation to protect, respect, and fulfill those rights. And that really does carry quite a burden on the state. And the other bit of language around human rights is this notion of progressive realization, so that a state, over time, begins to fulfill those rights obligations to the maximum available resources in society. Does that sound like a fair characterization of the types of NGOs that work in that area?
Yeah, definitely a fair characterization. I would say sometimes we look at those organizations differently because organizations that focus on economic, social, and cultural rights, although they'll still do some advocacy, a lot of times they're also doing service provision. So they might be the person that is actually giving the vaccinations or handing out food stuff after some sort of natural disaster.
So where does the funding come for an organization that does that kind of work? So they get a bit of money and they're actually doing frontline delivery of service. Who pays them and where do they get the resources to do that work?
Right. Well, there's lots of different ways that they can be paid. A lot of times they're getting paid through state governments, so through a country's foreign policy, they're getting paid that way. Sometimes they're getting paid from intergovernmental organizations. So think of things like the World Bank or the World Health Organization or the United Nations. Sometimes they're getting their money completely from private organizations or from private individuals. So they're looking at big donor foundations. Think of something like the Ford Foundation or Open Society. And sometimes it's just really small donations that they're getting either from people who are donating for some sort of religious reason or for some sort of personal reason.
And who coordinates all this activity? It sounds really strange that there's sort of a decentralized distribution of resource that some organizations are private, some are public, some are single organizations, others are intergovernmental that are giving money to third parties to deliver these services. So I'm curious about coordination. I'm also curious about accountability. So how accountable are these organizations for doing what they say they're going to do in the field?
Oh, these are big questions and these are big problems in the field of NGOs and in the field of just supporting rights and supporting the service delivery on the ground. So we know, unfortunately, that there's not as much coordination among NGOs as we would ideally think. So ideally, we think of, some sort of disaster happens and all of these groups go together and they try to make some sort of plan as to how to make sure that everyone is getting the food and the services they need, that they're not providing these in any sort of way that is unequal or missing people at the margins. Unfortunately, that just that doesn't happen on the ground. There was a really good piece from Political Science a little over a decade ago called the NGO Scramble. And what it really talks about is how in a situation where NGOs are needed the most, these are sometimes the situations where NGOs are trying to scramble with each other to get the same types of money, get the same donations. They're providing resources, and they're not having to coordinate with each other as much as, you know, we would maybe ideally think they would.
So in many ways, the accountability question is kind of related to the mad scramble argument. And there's another great work that I like in political science called The Marketing of Rebellion by Clifford Bob. And in there, he argues that not only is there a scramble, but there's a kind of interesting story around who is successful in attracting the world's attention. And he says, even given the same resource or the scramble that's taking place, some organizations are better at framing their struggles than others, and therefore they catch the attention of the international community. Now, I realize that you work on international NGOs, but I suspect there's probably a bit of a game around how we market things. And one of the examples he gave was about the Ogoni people in Nigeria, who'd been displaced by oil exploration by Shell Oil. And at first they tried to frame it as an environmental problem. But then when violence erupted and people from the Ogoni movement died as a result of their interaction with both Shell but also with the Nigerian state, it was reframed as a human rights problem. And that's what really grabbed the attention of international actors, donors, and then there was money and support for the movement within Nigeria. Do you find similar dynamics at stake in the work that you've done?
I absolutely do. So there's some issues that are receiving a lot of attention, not because that's what a local population really wants, but they're receiving a lot of attention and a lot of funds because that's what the international community is requesting. So that's what they're wanting to get a whole bunch of proposals on. And this can create some problems, just like Clifford Bob found in his work. So it can create some problems where only those really savvy domestic groups are able to get attention, so that attention and aid is not based on just need, but really based on how viable an issue is or how viable it's seen to be with the larger community. And so this can result in, you know, some focus on issues that local constituents don't see as important, and a lack of attention on other issues. And all of this really matters for the effectiveness of these organizations on the ground. They can spend a lot of money on an issue, but if they don't have that domestic resonance, it's very unlikely that that issue will be one that they'll be able to make some long-lasting change on.
Another question I have really is around, how does one sustain an NGO? So NGOs are formed, there may be one or two people who found it, they get a board together, they may get some initial patrons that support them. They then either are a membership organization or some sort of sponsorship organization. They then compete for funds. They build up a staff base. And there's a professionalization that takes place within an NGO structure. But at the same time, there's an overriding concern of the financial sustainability of NGOs. So how do they keep it going? How does something like Amnesty International or Greenpeace or ActionAid or any of these really big INGOs keep it going? What is it that this sort of explains the success in maintaining their organizational structures and their sort of financial sustainability?
This is a great question, Todd. Elizabeth Bloodgood, and they're doing some work on NGO death. And so I wish we knew more about this, about how long NGOs typically last and what are the factors that lead to them dying out. Because we do know that, you know, the vast majority of NGOs aren't those long-lasting large organizations that you just mentioned. So a lot of them are mom-and-pop organizations or a few people that come together over an issue. And for a variety of reasons, those types of NGOs can never make it to the main stage. So I think that's definitely an issue that we need to, as scholars, look at a lot more. The other issue you raised about longevity of an organization is the tactics that organization has to adopt to stay viable and to stay in the game. And there's a really great book by Sarah Bush where she talks about this in relation to democracy assistance. And so she talks about the fact that organizations that became heavily dependent on some sources of U.S. aid really tamed down the tactics they were using on democracy assistance, in order to keep receiving that money. And so over time, you can see a changing of what organizations are focusing on in order to remain viable and to keep in business. You definitely see, just like you said, this professionalization. So more report writing, more hiring of people who have experience in NGO operations or who have master's degrees in public policy and that sort of thing. And so you see this professionalization of the NGO sector over time.
So a few years ago, I did an analysis and an evaluation for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Netherlands. And the question they were asking was, you know, we spend several hundred thousand euros per year on a series of human rights NGOs. And we want to know whether what NGOs are telling us they're doing, they're actually doing. So it was a real interest in accountability. And one of the things, one of the organizations I analyzed was Penal Reform International. And here's an organization that works for prisoners' rights, but also prison conditions and sentencing and a range of issues associated with prisoners around the world. But one of the things that fascinated me was that they were doing some work in Rwanda after the terrible events there, and they discovered that about 135,000 men were in prison. And this took them out of the economy. So Penal Reform International had international money, and they started to train these prisoners how to make things like bricks, beds, houses, etc., in the view that they would give them some skills, some transferable and tradable skills, so that when they came out of prison, they could actually contribute to the economy again. And so here's a putative kind of human rights NGO working on things like incarceration and prisoner rights that was actually teaching people how to build bricks and houses. And I just wondered if you found in your work on INGOs that there is this kind of movable feast, if you will, between the activities NGOs get engaged in, precisely for the reasons that I illustrate in that example.
The comparative advantage for NGOs is really being innovative, just like your example showed. So an organization can go in, they can say, look, what we're doing isn't working. We need to think about this in a different way. And unlike a state government or a military, they can change quickly. And I think this is why, you know, having multiple NGOs active within a community, even though it can lead to all these problems of cooperation that we talked about earlier, this is also why it's a good thing. And that's because multiple NGOs can take different paths to all reach the same overarching goal. And if they can cooperate, then we have the best of both worlds. We have innovation in lots of different directions, and we also have, you know, people coming together with this idea of the same goal.
That's great. So the original question we asked was about whether NGOs make a difference, and I think we need to nail that down. So years ago, about 1999, and then again in 2013, there were an edited volume called The Power of Human Rights. In that book, I felt in 1999, the argument was that NGOs advocating for human rights can make a difference, but the difference they make obviously is subject to a number of contributing factors at the national level, but also at the international level. And one of the sort of theories or one of the sort of concepts they use was this notion of a transnational advocacy network. And they break it down into the fact that there are groups at the national level that want to change the human rights situation, but for whatever reason they find they cannot. So they might live in situations where the government is highly repressive. So they articulate those demands to a level that's above the country, but not all the way to the United Nations. So it's this sort of middle ground, if you will, between international organizations like the United Nations or the European Union, for example, and state levels that your examples of INGOs are operating. And this notion of a network of INGOs, this transnational level, is something that can bring about real change at the ground level. And I just wondered what your reflections were, you know, sort of many years after that book came out, even after a couple of years after the follow-up book came out, in your experience working with INGOs, how much of that framework is helpful, and what does your research show for the real impact of NGOs?
I really think my whole career has been trying to find ways to test the empirical implications that come out of that book, especially on the large scale. And it's remarkable. There's a lot of empirical implications that come out of that book that I think I've found some support for, at least on the large scale.
So when you say large scale, have you been doing sort of quantitative analysis? So you're looking at many organizations over time and space. Is that the sort of analysis that you've conducted?
I'm the kind of person that likes numbers. And so I've looked at these questions looking at a large number of countries. So sometimes, you know, 100 countries or more. So 1980 to the present, usually, or 1990 to the present, and looking at a large number of organizations. So I've worked to try to capture what these organizations are doing and the attention these organizations are receiving. And typically I use a list of about 1,000 human rights organizations and what they are doing throughout the world.
And what do you find on aggregate? You know, what are the sort of main stylized findings of that research?
The main finding is that human rights organizations can work to improve human rights conditions on the ground, but that their work is not automatic. So if they have no connection to the local population, if they're just talking, if they're just shaming, as we would call it, at the international scale, a state's behavior, but they have no domestic presence, they're very unlikely to be effective. But just like that book you were mentioning, just like it says about this advocacy network idea, if they're actually connected, if they actually have a domestic presence, I find that that's when we can see these organizations be successful. And if they can't have a domestic presence, we also find that if they're able to at least get next door or nearby the country that's repressing, and they can conceivably sneak into the country, that we also find that they're effective at changing human rights behavior on the ground, that they actually make things better off for the local population.
So it sounds to me like, you know, the networks work, proximity works, but there's also a lot of risk involved in this work. So you were talking about getting close to the action, maybe getting into places that they should, you know, have difficulty getting into. What's your understanding of the risks associated with this work?
Yeah, so I think it is really risky for all organizations, but it's especially risky for those that are advocating for human rights change as opposed to service delivery. So I had a paper with a scholar named Craig Stapley a couple years ago where we look at where NGOs are at risk for terrorist attacks. And what we find is that it's the human rights organizations, and they're being really an alternative to terrorist organizations and countering what the state is doing, that their behavior can actually put NGOs at risk. And they not only those organizations, those human rights organizations, but just all organizations. It can make this situation where the organization is seen as an other or as a risky alternative to what's going on domestically. And that can create an outbidding process, or a process where the terrorist organization is really threatened by what's going on.
So I want to ask you a few more questions, if I may. And one is about the motivation for the work that you do. I'm curious, what got you interested in this topic? You know, you wake up one day, look out of the world, and you say, that's what I'm going to work on. Why is it that you work on NGOs, and why did you take the particular approach that you took?
My work on organizations started early. So I had a father that was really active in environmental causes, and he worked for the state government. So he worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But he could see that there were things that were being done by NGOs that were very quick. So if you wanted something done to protect animals, an NGO was much better to get that thing done quickly as opposed to focusing on a government channel. And so I think I grew up at the dinner table hearing these things about how NGOs were able to get things done quickly. And so when I started studying international relations as an undergrad, I really gravitated to, you know, what was going on that local people like me were involved in. And once I read Kekin Sakink and Risa Roppin Sakink, I think that's when I was like, okay, there's some great theory here, and we need some of these theoretical arguments to be put to the empirical chopping block. We need to see whether they're actually working or not.
And that's really interesting. So, you know, you've gone from the ground up, you've done this sort of systematic data set construction and statistical analysis, and find that, you know, a quite nuanced answer. They matter, but they matter if they're close and they're networked, etc. So you've corroborated in many ways the hunches and the theories that were in those earlier works that inspired you. So that's a good news story for the social science endeavor, but also for the endeavor around advocacy for human rights. Because sometimes I think people get a bit frustrated and they think, is it really worth it? And is all this money going to good use? And actually, your empirical results suggest that it probably is worth it, and most of it's going to good use. Is that a fair characterization?
I think that's fair. I think not all of it is, and not all situations are NGOs successful. So in my book, when I focus on development organizations and getting people access to clean water and those sort of things, if NGOs are involved in very corrupt states, they're likely to behave as corruptly as the government's behaving and be really ineffective at getting change on the ground.
I want to finish by just asking, it's probably a personal question, but you have a reputation for being a goat keeper. And I think this might be interesting. When we talked about having you record a podcast with us. There's been some interest out there in exactly what it is that you're doing with these goats in the middle of Missouri. So just could you tell us by way of closing what it is you're doing with goats in Missouri?
Well, I'm not only doing things with goats, I'm doing things with goats, pigs, turkeys, and chickens. I live on a 5-acre hobby farm that backs up to the Mark Twain National Forest. For 2.5 years, I milked 2 goats twice a day. Sadly, my husband does not like me being gone, and he does not like milking the goats, and so we're transitioning from goats to pigs, which he likes a lot better. But we have 14 baby pigs outside right now that are just adorable. And actually, this afternoon, I will be butchering turkeys. So tomorrow, or Thursday, is Thanksgiving, and we have organic farm fresh turkeys that are being butchered today for people to pick up.
That's fantastic. So from environmental protection to human rights, right back to the dinner table. I think that's a great way to end what we were talking about today. So I really appreciate you being on this episode of the Rights Track. I think we learned a lot about an area that has some skepticism, but the hard work that people are putting in, the thousands of NGOs that you've analyzed, and the positive benefits that come out of that work that you've shown through your research and through your empirical analysis. So it's for me just to say thank you very much for joining us today, Amanda, and we wish you well.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. The project is funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and you can find additional information and resources at www.rightstrack.org.